Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. This magazine, it's not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible. And it's delivered right to your front door 4 times a year, each issue filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including little old me from time to time. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, so if you want to join in on the fun, well, you're going to need to subscribe. So in order to do that, just head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up. And if you use the code KINGCAST at checkout, you will save a massive 25% off of your subscription. That's Fangoria.com, code KINGCAST. Now on with the show.
Hi. My name is Stephen King.
Is gonna break!
Red rum! Red rum!
You guys wanna go see a dead body?
Well, sometimes death is better.
Welcome to the KINGCAST, where we go deep with actors, writers, filmmakers, and other creative types about their work and their favorite stories from Mr. Stephen King. I'm Anthony Bresnigan.
And I'm Eric Vespi.
And we're your hosts on this endeavor. And Eric, we have news to break today on the KINGCAST. That's very exciting.
I know. Look at us. We're being all official-like.
Yeah, the KINGCAST has its stop the press moment. Stop the podcast. Is there is there an equivalent?
I don't know. It probably involves an EMP or something. I should probably be a little bit more on my game to come up with a world-ending, you know, holy crap, breaking news podcast format-breaking words here. Yeah.
Well, this isn't going to stop the world, but it's cool news. It's very cool news. It involves our guest today, Benjamin Percy. He wrote a really great book called The Deadlands and Red Moon, and he's a comic book writer, too. He wrote Darth Maul, Red, White, and Black, among many, many others. Batman for Detective Comics. He's written about Predator taking out Wolverine and taking on Spider-Man and taking on the whole Marvel universe. That's very cool. He's a literary writer as well, published in the Paris Review. He really covers all bases. And the news he has to share today is about a special new project he's got, but it also pertains to Stephen King. And before we get into that, let's welcome Benjamin Percy to the show.
Hey, thanks everybody for listening, and thanks to you two for having me on.
It's great. It's great to talk to you. Well, we spoke on the phone the other day. You answered, and I was like, oh my gosh, do I have the right guy? We got a comment on your amazing radio voice, and thank you for bringing the dulcet tones to our show.
I bring the thunder. You didn't know the voice of the witness protection program was an actual dude.
We have Optimus Prime himself on the show today.
Oh my gosh, yes, exactly.
I'm a hairy Decepticon.
Roll out.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, you could give old Peter Cullen a run for his money, for sure. But it's great to have you.
This episode of the KINGCAST should come with a warning. Your ears may bleed by the end of this episode.
But it's wonderful to have you here. And by way of a little drum roll for this breaking news we're going to reveal here today, let me give just a little bit of backstory for the listeners. Eric, I was looking at Blue Sky over the weekend, and I saw a message from a writer friend of mine, Ethan Sachs. He's also a wonderful comic book scribe. He has a book called Haunted Girl that he wrote with his daughter, Naomi. I'll give him a little plug here. That's a fabulous comic. You can get the collection. It's out there on wherever books are sold. And Ethan said this. His little tweet on Blue Sky was, "As a former newspaper journalist, this is candy for my brain." And he was sharing the candy for his brain was from Benjamin Percy. Benjamin was unveiling this new project, and here's how he described it. Quote, "A short novel told in the form of a newspaper delivered to your home for a year. Should be a fun experiment." I thought that sounded fun. Yeah. I signed up right away. The title of this experiment is The End Times. It's a serialized post-apocalyptic tale published by Bad Hand Press. And Ben, I'm going to let you explain how this works. It's a newspaper, comes to your mailbox. Tell us more.
It's an experiment. It's an experiment that pushes back against publishing norms. It's an experiment that pushes back against storytelling forms. And I've had this itch I wanted to scratch for some time. An experimental story that takes the form of a newspaper. In part, it came from the small town that I live in. I don't know if it's old middle age or what, but like I've become fascinated with local news, and I'll linger over the obituaries, and I'll read this, how the high school football team is doing, and I'll be thrilled learning all about the church organist who's retiring after 50 years at the UCC. Anyways, our local newspaper is written almost exclusively by one person.
That's how it is these days, right? It's like a one man band or one woman band.
Indeed. And I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about finding your purpose, like finding a place in an apocalyptic landscape as a writer or editor. Here's somebody who might be a blacksmith, here's somebody who might be a farmer, but what about, I always have writers telling me, like, I have no marketable skills, I have no skills beyond what I'm able to conjure at the keyboard. And so, like, what if we, found ourselves as writers wandering through a world, that has fallen apart? This woman, the main character of the story, the editor, and not sole writer of the paper, but she writes a lot of it. She stumbles upon, when scavenging one day, an old printing press. And she decides that her thing will be this. She's going to start a newspaper. So she begins by posting it in the central square of this town. This is 10 years after the apocalypse. The point of this is not that the world is ending. The world has ended, and it's rebuilding. And so she starts by posting this in the central square, then gains more and more popularity. And it starts to become a sort of situation that I describe as a blend of like Station 11 and Our Town, as different people's voices start to fill the paper. And there's some very dark stuff going on in the background as well. And because you're getting this in your inbox or in your mailbox once a month, there's like a natural bit of suspense built in as you have to wait, those 30 days to see what happens next. Obituaries, there's birth announcements, there's cooking tips, there's breaking news, there's comics, there's anything that you might find in a newspaper. We're trying to give you the post-apocalyptic version of it.
Now, you mentioned it's mostly written by one person, but that there are other contributors. Is that where our connection to Stephen King comes in?
It is indeed.
All right.
So this is the breaking news.
Yeah, we need like a news bulletin sound effect, Eric. Like,
I know.
do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
All right, I'll get on it in post. There'll be an incredible like Fleischer era Superman newspaper sound here.
There it is. So what's the Stephen King connection to the end times?
The news is this, and we can get into how I know King and how I fell in love with King's writing a little bit later, but for now, just like the big news is, I asked King if he would be willing to contribute. He immediately wrote back and said yes, and he has a contributor to the paper. So I'm not going to give too much away, but let's just say some of what I already have in my inbox involves scarecrows with large button eyes and dead rats and bodies dangling from the rafters of barns, and even King Special.
Is he playing playing? Is he writing as a character, like a
He
certain
is
body
writing
line?
as a character.
Oh,
So
that's so fun.
he has a, I'm not going to say too much more, but let's just say there might be some Bachman in the byline.
Oh,
Interesting,
interesting.
interesting. Very cool. He said yes right away. I can imagine this being the kind of thing he would eat up as just as a fan, like because he's done serialized storytelling with The Green Mile
Right. And that is the way that I consume The Green Mile. I was in fifth grade. I was, hiking to my very sad Walden Books in a very sad mall, and picking up those installments. That's how I consume the Green Mile. Such a fun experience. And it's not just that, you know, I think helped me pitch this to him, but also it essentially takes place in the world of The Stand, you know, a different sort of corner.
Right. Interesting.
Of that universe.
Well, I was going to ask you too about the world you're in, because you have The Deadlands, which is a novel about a world that has moved on. But in that book, it's the catastrophes fell 150 years before. So that's, you know, it's like Civil War era for our times now. So it's a I guess a society that the Sanctuary is this sort of rebuilt authoritarian society that is. Very distant from the actual fall of the world, but this isn't the same universe, right? It's not, this isn't a continuation.
No, it's not the same universe. The Deadlands has a touch of magic to it. This is the End Times is very grounded. Most of the horror is human, and it takes place 10 years after everything's fallen apart. You know, there's the equivalent of a Captain Trips virus, you know, that's ripped through the population. Only 1% of us have survived. People call it the Reds because it's a hemorrhaging fever that takes you over. And but anyways, that's not the concern, right? We've all seen endless iterations of the world falling apart. And again, this is about reconstruction. So 10 years after. Threats still loom, but they're a different sort of threat than, you know, whether somebody's coughing in your vicinity.
Which might be extra poignant right now, you know, because we're kind of like on the other side of our own mini outbreak, right? And it's still, you know, COVID's still something we have to think about and deal with. But, you know, we're, as people do, we're moving on past it and learning to kind of live with it and adapting to it. You know, in our case, luckily we have some treatments for it, so it's not as deadly as when it broke out. But it's there is that weird feeling, though, having living, you know, lived through that kind of shared trauma with everybody and going like, was that like a fever dream that happened a few years ago where we all were just, you know, locked up together or by ourselves in some cases, you know?
Yeah, and, I think there's absolutely that. And I'm always trying to, I think horror is most effective, right? When you're channeling cultural unease. And and there's also, you know, the another thing that I think people will find resonant, and that is that the news in this case, the End Times, you know, it's a way that people are brought together as a community. It's a way that people are educated. It's a way that people are entertained. And in a way, journalism is saving lives in this story.
Right.
Is that the masthead? Is that what your writer, what she calls her newspaper, the End Times? Is that like
the End Times is the name of the paper?
That's a great name.
And, the tagline of it is the very most of the little we know.
That's fabulous, man. I love it. It's like what's the New York Times one? All the news.
All
that's
the news
fit to print.
That's fit to print.
When I was in newspapers, we changed that to all the news that fits, we print. Everybody, and then there was, oh gosh, where was it? I think it was it the, I was, I also, I started out at the Arizona Republic, and theirs was one of America's great newspapers, but internally, you know, the employees would grumble and they called it one of America's newspapers. you always have a way to talk shit about your own publication, but that's a great that's a great tagline for it. I think that's awesome. So to just wrap up the King element here, is it a two-person show behind this The End Times, or are you opening it up to some other writer friends? I know you have a lot of friends.
Right, that was just King
community.
But I have had a few other people express interest, so we'll see. It could be fun to bring on some of my comics folks, you know, since I've been writing for Marvel or for DC for the past 11 years or so, and I've got a nerds I could call up with the red telephone, the emergency nerd hotline. And I've had a few people too who are journalists and a few other novelists who are like, hey, you need something? So it could be a lot of fun to make this a true chorus of voices.
Well, I would love it if this turns into like an actual, like, you're like, well, I can't just end it after 12 months now I have to have it be a continual thing. So Where can people go to sign up and get all this stuff? So we, you know, we got to make this a success so we can really blow this out, I think.
So, if you know, interest is there, we will continue this. Right now it's planned for 12 months. And at the end of it, we are going to put together like an oversized book that still retains the look of a look and feel of a newspaper. Mm-hmm. The place you go to sign up for this is Bad Hand Books. So when I was first inquiring about the idea, it became very clear that nobody in New York was interested in the logistical nightmare of putting out a newspaper. And I was sniffing around. There's this place called Bad Hand Books in the Midwest, which is where I'm located, and they're doing really cool stuff. They're publishing horror writers like Clay McLeod Chapman and Bracken McLeod, Laird Barron. They're winning Bram Stoker Awards. They're scrappy, but they are doing extraordinary work. And that's sort of like what I'm after right now, is somebody who can go into the trenches with me in this experiment. So contacted them. It turns out Doug Morano, the owner, the editor, he has a mother-in-law who owns a small town newspaper. And so we were able to use that facility.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But you go to Bad Hand Books website and you can sign up. And, you know, we're working in some deals with this where people who sign up for a digital subscription, we're going to also give them a 15% discount on the final book. That comes out more than a year from now. We're going to do some other stuff too, you know, in the spirit of generosity. Like, I reached out to Stephen King. He had every reason to say no, but in that same spirit of generosity, after 500 digital subscriptions, for every subscription beyond that, we're going to donate $1 to the ACLU. You head over to the website, you sign up, and come November, the horror begins.
That's generous of you with ACLU. That's a great way to support freedom of speech, right? Yeah. That's such an important part. Maybe that'll save us from sliding into an actual apocalypse.
A fake end of the world might help prevent the real one. Yeah.
So correct me if this has changed, Ben, but when I signed up, and the reason I did it with speed was you said we're only going to print 500 copies.
Yeah. So for those who subscribe by mail, where it's going to show up, you know, at your house once a month, we just didn't have the bandwidth to do more than 500 a month, you know, because we're working.
And that's a logistics problem, not just a writing.
It makes it more special. Like, it's a collector's item now, right? Mm-hmm. So those who got on the bandwagon immediately, you know, we sold out of those physical copies over the weekend, but digital subscriptions are limitless, right? And at the end of that digital subscription for a year, you have the ability to buy like your own physical object. Mm-hmm. You know, that's cool. Volume.
The digital subscription, is it text, or is it going to come as like a PDF that looks
like
come
as a PDF?
Newspaper?
It looks like we've got the first issue formatted. It looks like an old time newspaper.
Mm-hmm. Are you doing this?
And again, like, there's also there's comics in this. There's maps in this. My friend Matt Bowers, who's a Swiss Army knife of a human being and is good at everything. It's always good to have one of those guys in your pocket. He's doing the art for it. But it looks like an old printing press. Like an old timing.
I love that. Go ahead.
I was just gonna say, I'm really disappointed that I'm just now hearing about it after it sold out, the physical stuff, because I'm a physical collector, man. So now I'm getting
the big book will have the exact look.
Well, good.
Of those good. Initial.
And you know what? It won't be as like all over the place. You know, like King back in the day had his Castle Rock newsletter. You get those; they're great, but they go all over the place. Have it all in one contained space.
That's how I read comics. I love graphic novels and all, but comic books, the monthly installment. But I prefer to have the whole book in one place. I guess maybe that's heretical to comic fans, but I'm impatient. Like,
that's the way I read comics as well. Mm-hmm. I read them, you know, as trade volumes now.
Yeah.
I'm so impatient. I don't want to have to sometimes wait a month. to figure
a
out
weird kind
what
of
happened to Dr. Doom.
Yeah, it's a weird kind of impatience because I'd rather wait a whole year for it than wait a month for the next. You know, it's sort of you gotta pause your.
That's the real challenge of a comics writer, comics artist, though, is like we have to write and draw issues that are so bonkers, right? So wild that when you get to page 20 and you set that thing down, that your adrenaline is still humming a month later when you need to get to the comic shop to see how things continued. Imagine if a TV show was like that.
Mm-hmm.
Would you wait a month to know what happened on, you know, CSI Miami?
Well, not really, but then also we're conditioned to wait like 3 years in between, you know, Game of Thrones or Stranger Things seasons. Yeah. So it's weird, but I guess that's more in line with what we were talking about with the trade paperback or the trade volume, right? Where you're not trade paperback, but, you know, the trade volumes for this stuff, the graphic novel collections where, yeah, you're going to wait a long time, but you're going to get it all in one rush, you know? Yeah.
You know, this is a newspaper guy question, but I'm curious, what's the format? Because you could have a broadsheet like New York Times or a tabloid like the New York Post, you know, a little square sized. What's the size of the End Times?
It's the same as the New York Times, except
a broadsheet.
In a more old, like filtered through a historical lens because we're using, you know, the printing press format.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
But yeah, I mean, I'll just like, I can potentially just read like a small little thing right here.
Yeah, give us a sample.
This is just like the briefest of brief little missives, but the headline here is Strange Effigy. An oily bundle of sticks tied together with red cloth and arranged to look like a figure with horns was found at the intersection of Division and Third. There was a ring of human teeth around it. If anyone has any more information about this, please contact the End Time.
If anybody's missing any teeth.
Ben, I love that you already possess the voice of God, but you amp it up when you read. It's even better.
I write Wolverine, but I also eat 3 Wolverines a day. That's why I sound.
This is cool, man. You know, your storytelling, if I were to connect some dots in what I've read of your work, you often write about human beings and their connection to the world, to nature. And I know that was a big part of your first novel, The Wilding.
Yeah.
And it sounds like that's a part of the End Times too. And would you say that that's connective tissue between your literary output, your novels as a whole?
That is a unifying strand in everything I write. Is, you know, I grew up in the woods and that predator prey boundary, you know, the primal self, you'll see that explored in, you know, Marvel Comics, when I'm writing Wolverine, you'll see that explored when I'm writing a novel like The Wilding, which is about a hunting expedition gone wrong. You'll see that in The End Times, which, you know, you have civilization, you know, a very rudimentary form of civilization battling back against the elements.
I feel like just in real life, human beings and nature are in a constant arm wrestling competition, and that an apocalypse kind of gives nature nature always has the upper hand, as we've seen countless. All it takes is a hurricane, a tornado, a wildfire, and your nice little town is obliterated, and there's a terrible loss of life and tragedy all around, but an apocalypse just sort of wrestles the whole fucking world right back against the table. I assume
if you look at what's going on right now, politically, environmentally, right? It just sometimes the end of the world has never seemed more probable. So, narrative, which feels like a rehearsal.
Right? Well, it does.
Which is so weird. And this is something we've touched on a few times on the show, especially when we kind of talk around like The Stand. But there's something about a lot of people, I won't say it's everybody, but it's certainly with me, there's a weird, like, prepper slash wish fulfillment thing that comes with these apocalyptic tales, right? I don't know if you guys feel this, but it's, you know, when Wampler was around, he would talk about like look he would look forward to the apocalypse in a weird way, like and would daydream about what it would be like to go around and not have bills to pay, not have, you know, be able to walk in wherever. And I'm like, well, you're daydreaming about like the immediate aftermath, right? Where you can just walk into Home Depot and get all your supplies that you need. But what happens when all the canned food starts running out? And he's like, oh yeah, I don't want to be around for any of that shit. He's like, but you know, there is a weird wish fulfillment thing that happens. And I see people, you know, I mean, when you look at like the success of The Last of Us or like, you know, The Walking Dead or like in pop culture, we keep revisiting this idea of the end times. And there is something about it where I think that even the common person thinks about it. Maybe they're just tired of humanity at a certain point, or maybe they're, you know, I don't know, just feeling constrained by their 9 to 5 or whatever. But it's such a ripe thing that people are still like always, 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 always drawn to. Is that something you guys have felt as well, or is that something you have any answer as to why humans long for the days when trees start overgrowing cities and you know, and you can just walk into any store and grab whatever you want. You know, I don't know.
My childhood can only be described as pre-apocalyptic. My parents were back to the Landers. We had electricity, but you know, we had a chicken coop, we had animals, we had elaborate garden. My dad hunted most of our meat. And so, we had 27 acres of big pines in Oregon, and so, I when I'm watching Thundar the Barbarian, and when I'm 5 years old, I can't wait for the moment when I'm in my hairy underwear with my lightning sword. You know, I'm ready. And I guess I've never really escaped that mindset, in that, I live in the woods now. I lived in the woods as a kid. I live in the woods now, and I wouldn't say that I'm a prepper, but I would also say I'm not a prepper. In that, my wife cans extensively. We've got a generator built into the house. I have enough toilet paper, ammo, and whiskey to last me, a few years at least.
Nothing humbles you like I live in Texas, and Austin froze over, you know, for that week. We were without power and snowed into our homes, and nothing humbles you more than boiling pots of water on your gas stove and thankful that you have a gas stove. And just showed me how just completely unprepared I was for any of this stuff. And yeah, no, I'm really jealous. My future in-laws just built, because they live in Georgia in kind of a hurricane zone, and they built a gas generator, like a natural gas generator, on the side of their house. And I'm like, well, shit, if only I'd had that during the snowstorm, I might not have been worried that my pets were going to freeze to death overnight.
I put mine in after a hurricane shouldered up against our neighborhood, and we lost power for a week. And yeah, a lot of trees came down, including one on our. And yeah, after that, I was like, I'm
Never again.
gonna be ready next time.
Well,
Gonna
we should
wrestle
talk.
that tornado to the ground and watch some Netflix while I do it.
Oh man, it's so yeah. I'm a night owl. I've always been a night owl, going back to when I was a kid. I just prefer to stay up late and wake up late. You know, that's kind of my go-to. That switched like instantaneously when the power was out, because when the power's out and it gets dark, there's fucking nothing to do. And I'm just like, oh, this is what most of human existence has been like. I can't see. Time
Can't
to sleep.
read.
It's
No
just
TV.
Eric and his feelings.
Yeah. Can't do it. Yeah, it's like, you know, I don't have enough candles to not risk burning my house down while I'm trying to read a book or something. So when it got dark, I went to sleep. But we should talk a little bit about some Stephen King stuff. So this is the King cast. Well, more than what we've talked about, obviously. We've talked about you're actually getting to collaborate in a fun way with King. But you mentioned before we started recording that you have kind of two angles to your Stephen King origin story. Do you want to dive into the traditional one first, and then you can get into the second one after?
Sure. The traditional one is that I've always been a horror head, and my parents are big readers. I grew up in a house where, as romantic as this might sound in a time of screens that we live in, almost every evening we were sprawled out in the living room reading together. I'd be reading a horror novel. My sister would be reading like a book about physics or something. She's the outlier of the family. My mom would be reading a Western novel. My dad would be reading sci-fi. But that was every night in our house. And so, horror was always around me. And Stephen King was on the shelves even before I was grabbing those novels. But the first time that he had a real impact on me as a reader was with The Gunslinger. And that's a book. I can't tell you how many times I've read it, because I read it over and over and over again through middle school and high school. And I was going through a bit of a rough time then. I was, we'd moved around a bit. I was always the new kid. I was getting into fights. I got kicked out of one school. And when I read The Gunslinger, I, for whatever reason, just really aligned with Roland, I think in part because he was a nomad, but he was always completely at home with himself, and he had this code, no matter how problematic, this code that he followed. And it was, the equivalent of like knighthood or something, and so I, as weird as this sounds now in reflection, right, there was almost like this, instead of WWJD on a bracelet, it was like, what would Roland do? And it really did
He would
influence.
kill the whole town, is what he
That's
would
right. That's when I killed an entire town of people.
and feel only a
I
little
grew up in a
teeny,
hut.
teeny, tiny bit sad about it, just a little bit.
And I was the constant reader. I read my way through everything that he wrote, including, I was talking about the serialized experience of the Green Mile, and including, some books we can talk about in connection to the end times as well, like Carrie, which, you have in your head one version of the story maybe, but you return to it and you realize that this is an epistolary novel in some ways. It's all built up of like, there are news articles in it, and there are, essentially diary entries and everything. It's like Dracula in that way.
Interviews and
And so a little bit of the end times is in that as well. So anyways, there's that version of King, right? And then there's the other version of my King origin story. And that origin story actually begins with Peter Straub, one of King's collaborators, the great horror writer, Peter Straub, who sadly passed away a few years ago. But I was at the Wisconsin Book Festival. I was reading from a story of mine. Peter Straub walks into the room. Peter Straub is another person I'd read obsessively as a kid. So I'm so intimidated. I'm in my mid-20s, so intimidated. He walks and he sits in the back row. He's this big, beast of a dude, and he's got this bald head that's just glowing under the dim lighting. And his glasses are flashing, their lights back, the light back at me. And I somehow make it through the reading. He comes up to me afterwards and he grabs me by the shoulders and he says, "You have someone inside of you. They have a buzz cut. They wear tight white t-shirts and tight blue jeans and motorcycle boots. They keep a machete duct taped to their chest because they always like to have a weapon within hand's reach and like to feel of metal on their skin." I was like, "Nice to meet you, Mr. Straub." And we became friends after that. I visited him in New York when I was there on book tour. He, involved me with a few anthologies he was putting out. He's the most generous guy in the world. Anyways, fast forward a little bit. I'm teaching because in my former life I used to be a professor. I'm teaching. My phone is blowing up during class. It's just buzzing constantly. I walk out into the hall afterwards. I look at my phone, wondering if the world is coming to an end. But what happened was Stephen King tweeted about one of my novels, Red Moon, which is a
Which
werewolf
one?
Red Moon,
Red Moon,
werewolf
great.
novel. And I was blown away that I would even, be able to have that much of a connection with what I can, very earnestly say is my hero. I wrote to Peter and I was like, "Peter, I don't want to break any boundaries here. If you feel comfortable, can you just tell Mr. King thank you for doing that? Because that was really awesome." Within 5 minutes, Stephen King emailed me. So just imagine me,
That's
weeping
a big day. That is a big day.
at my desk.
We he
So
because
yeah, he.
Steve should be unattainable. Like he's the guy we saved our money to buy books. I saved my money to buy paperbacks and worked my way through his he's a legend. And then when
I mean,
he
arguably as
materializes
much
in your
impact on
life.
contemporary culture as somebody like Shakespeare. Like he's just, it's God level status. And the fact that I'm just like some schlub from rural Minnesota and I'm somehow emailing back and forth with King and he read one of my books and then he blurbed the Deadlands as well. And I was able to interview him on stage at a book festival. And, I have never wanted to cross any line with him because, he is no doubt being approached by so many people constantly. So I try to respect some distance. But in the case of the End Times, I just couldn't, I held off for a month and I just couldn't not ask. So I asked and he said, yes, instantly, instantly.
Well, that's the thing about him. He's a legend. He is a legend, but he is also a human being. He's a person, and you treat him that way. That's why you have the relate. That's why he says yes, because you aren't hitting him up all the time asking for favors. He'd put you on that block list maybe, but you treat him. It's funny because I think he does. The attention would be overwhelming for any person. So he does have to have boundaries up. But I do think he likes to be treated like a fellow scribe. He loves other writers. He loves brothers and sisters in the profession. And I'm not surprised he said yes to this because, like I said, he probably thinks like, well, this would be a cool idea. I wish I'd thought of it. He had the plant back in the early, was that 99 or 2000s, where he was like
Was what?
digitally publishing before anybody else was doing it. That was an experiment. And the book we're going to talk about today was an experiment, The Cycle of the Werewolf, which he created in collaboration with Bernie Wrightson, who did these amazing, unforgettable, haunting illustrations. And that started out, I believe, as a calendar, didn't it?
Yeah, for
The
sure.
Stephen King calendar of, I don't know, 1984 or
Yeah,
something.
I think I look, he was attending like, World of Science Fiction convention or something in the early 80s, and I think the publisher is the one who approached him and was like, "Hey, we're doing this thing with Bernie Wrightson where he's doing a different werewolf attack essentially as a calendar image, because back in the, I think kids today they might go like, "What's that mean?" Because most kids today they think of calendar, they think of the thing you pull up on your iPhone or whatever. But back in the day, in order to know what your schedule was going to be like, you had a calendar on your wall, right? That would you would flip month to month and you would write down your important dates and stuff. And I guess the idea was that each month would be an image instead of a cute cat or, a
Or
Kathy
Cindy
cartoon or
Crawford.
something, or Cindy Crawford. It would be a horrific werewolf mauling and mutilation. And they said, "Steve, would you be interested in doing this?" And he's like, "Oh, that sounds like fun." And he it, and it's so funny, like one of my favorite things, and I'm sure we'll dive into this, but one of my favorite things about this is when you go into reading Cycle of the Werewolf knowing that, it's become so clear seeing his style as like he just can't help himself. Because the first month, it's like January, February, March. The whole idea is that, there's a lunar cycle every month, right? So that's perfect for a werewolf story. So you tell a year's worth of werewolf attack stories where every month there's a new attack, which kind of bullshittingly every month the attack, the full moon seems to happen on around the famous holiday for that month, which wouldn't happen, but fuck it, it's a fun idea. But you read like January's like a page and a half, and then February's a couple of pages, and then by the time you're in June, it's like real chapters of a book, and you can tell, he's going from the Friday the 13th style, this is the werewolf attack that happens, to fuck it, we're gonna introduce Marty Koslaw, we need a main character. We're going to introduce this person and this person, and that's where the arc's going to be. And by the end of it, it's like a full-on, narrative story. And I love it for that reason, because it's something that it's such a like a toe dipping into a completely different form of storytelling for him.
He addressed that lunar, the full moon during holiday thing in the afterword to the book. He goes, any moon watcher will know, regardless of the year, I've taken a good many liberties with the lunar cycle. Usually to take advantage of days like Valentine's Day, July 4th, etc., which mark certain months in our minds. To those readers who feel I didn't know any better, I did. The temptation was too great to resist. I like how Stephen King approaches his werewolf story with "fuck the moon." The moon will do what I tell it to do. But Benjamin, you wrote Red Moon, and you said that was the first book he read and tweeted about
Right, that's
and
right.
that's a werewolf
Werewolves
story.
have always been my favorite monster because we're all hairy on the inside. I've written about them in Red Moon. I've written about them in a novella called North Border, another one called The Wereworld. And The Wereworld completely rips off Cycle of the Werewolf in that I created a 12-month, scenario. And so I do the same thing. I go, from January through December, I've got my story. But the way that I crank things up is I made it sort of like a Cycle of the Werewolf meets The Purge, because I've never really bought into werewolf stories where, like, why is there just one?
Yeah, right.
If a werewolf's going out on the prowl, he's going to be biting people left and right, and that's going to spread, and that's going to spread, and that's going to spread like any,
It's a virus story.
And so, yeah, in the course of the Wereworld, it lives up to its title, in that essentially we're in lockdown about halfway through on nights of the full moon. But this book, I love what you're saying about it, Eric, where I could sort of see in Cycle of the Werewolf, I could see it becoming a novel. Like it wasn't a novel in the beginning, and then it becomes that thing by the end. When it finds, because it has like this kind of like what I was talking about with the end times, like a chorus of voices, it's the perspective is roaming around Tarker Mills, and before it sort of finds its person and finds its point of view.
No, it's great, and it also makes it one of the most fascinating adaptations as well with Silver Bullet, because that is King penned that script, and something that became apparent once we started the show and was like really taking a hard look at Silver Bullet, because that's a movie that I always loved growing up, but I just kind of associate, I'm like, yeah, it's just that it was a thing that I saw as a kid, so I love it because I saw it as a kid. But what becomes really interesting is when you look at Cycle of the Werewolf and Silver Bullet together, you see that this is King getting to start from scratch with the concept of, Marty, this kid in the wheelchair, being the main character, and you almost get to see it as like him editing his original,
A second crack at the story.
novel or novella, and like really fleshing it out and what he would do, and adding in the narrator aspect, and it's like you get all this I don't know. You see a glimpse into his process and like what he would do just revisiting an original idea that maybe he goes, well, shit, not only do I have to adapt it for a new medium, but like now's my chance to tell a complete story versus, something that starts off as one thing and then turns into a regular Stephen King tale halfway
It's
through.
almost like an Evil Dead 2 sort of situation, right? Where
Yeah, that's a great
revisiting the same
comparison.
territory, but cranking it up.
I got a budget now, motherfuckers.
But this also connects to your history with Red Moon and your other werewolf stories, but also this is a nice tie back to the end times. If you got a 12-month cycle and every month there's a new thing, so a new
And it's
story to
I, this
tell.
is one of those stories too where I actually miss, that's one thing I miss in the movie, is that 12-month cycle, because I just like the patience of it and the non-traditional form of it. So as much as I love the movie, and I encountered actually the movie before the book, and they're very much intertwined in my head, but that's one thing that, if we're going to relaunch Silver Bullet, that's the way I'd want to see it all play
Oh,
out.
100%. If it, like I would love to see somebody, welcome to Derry's incredible, and Muschietti wants to take and stab at another King property. Somebody with some power and some weight to go to some.
Flanagan, are you listening? Come
Yeah,
on.
Mike, you have that deal at
12-part
Amazon,
series on
Mike.
Netflix, Flanagan.
No, it's I would love to see somebody tell like a 12 episode retelling of the story. And honestly, we just need, because that movie is really good, but the werewolf design sucks so much ass. It's like, it looks like a werebear. Like, you look at that Bernie Wrightson art, and it's one of the coolest looking werewolves that's ever been designed, right? You get it's very Rob Bottin Howling-esque with the pointy ears and the long snout and the, I don't know. There's something very menacing and terrifying about that. And then, you watch the movie and you get this like kind of chonky boy that's in, I think in its final
That's a
form
good
is great,
line.
but it doesn't live up to Everett McGill being, the fucking coolest dude ever to potentially turn into a werewolf, right? What spoilers, by the way, if you've never seen it, but.
But I would say that even if the werewolf transformation in the end is slightly werebear, as you said,
Yes.
like some of the transformation moments are great. The bubbling face and the claws,
The dream sequence is great, yeah.
popping out, and of course, I mean, the church sequence, like
Right.
that is fantastically horrifying and comical.
Do
Which
you
is
have
in.
a f Oh, go ahead,
Oh,
Eric. Go ahead.
sorry. I just want to, since we touched on that, which is really interesting to me on the dream sequence, because I've talked to people with two schools of thought on that. One, set thinks that it tips the hat and goes, well, they reveal who the werewolf is. And to me, I don't see it that way. Like I when I was watching the movie for the first time, because I think I'm like you, I think I saw the movie before I read the Cycle of the Werewolf. I didn't interpret it that way. I interpreted that as him being scared of like, everything dying around. You know what I mean? And in this concept of these maulings and things. Like I actually thought it was a fairly clever bit of hiding who the werewolf is, because it feels like it'd be too obvious to
I
have the
agree with
actual
you.
werewolf having a nightmare about everybody around him, not him turning into a
Right.
werewolf, right?
He looks out at the congregation and it could be any one of them. And I mean, the movie is again so entwined in my mind with the book that sometimes, I'm thinking of, I'm reading one of the chapters and I'm like, that's not the way it went.
Do you have a favorite Bernie Wrightson illustration?
Oh, when I look through them, I mean, he's one of the greats. His Frankenstein's Laboratory, if you've never seen that, I could stare at that one piece of art for hours at a time. But in this book, there's a few moments that stand out. What I love most is when you have, the ordinary and the extraordinary brought together. So, here's a werewolf in an all-night diner, or here's a werewolf crouched on top of a truck, in the middle of the town, as opposed to like a wilderness setting for a werewolf. But I think the two of them stand out for me. One is where the cop is getting his face shredded away, and you can see like the smile of his jawline,
That's the
and
one.
there it is.
mustache, and just that wrinkled snout of the werewolf there is so fantastic. I love the framing of it from inside the car, but also the pig slaughter really messed me up as a kid, seeing, just the animals torn asunder, and that head, the head of the pig, like piked
Half eaten,
on that fence.
yeah. The cop is so disturbing because there's no blood. It's almost like his face is, it's this freeze frame of the instant he gets shredded, and so it hasn't started bleeding yet, and it just looks like clay being pulled away from his face and his jaw, the skeletal jaw
And
underneath.
just how effortless it looks too, right? Where it's just something that happens, yeah.
And as somebody who grew up reading comic books, and now writes comic books, like I feel like these books too, like they presented a hybridized, storytelling form for me. And I encountered that as well in The Gunslinger, which
Right.
is spotted with illustrations in The Stand, the version
Also
of The
by
Stand.
Bernie Wrightson. Didn't he do the early illustrations for Gunslinger? Am I
No, that
right?
was Michael Whalen.
Oh,
Yeah.
sorry.
Whalen did Gunslinger, but he did do the stand for
That's what I was thinking of.
the
Yeah. With
thicker
Mother
one.
Abigail and the wolves,
Yeah.
like keeping them at bay. That's what I'm sorry. That's what I was thinking of.
Yeah,
That
the
that's led me to, the fairy tales of Greg Hildebrand or certain copies of Dickens' A Christmas Carol. And it's also brought me to certain comic book writers like Jonathan Hickman and his Black Monday murders, which is one of many examples of his where you have like illustrations, but you also have prose heavy passages. And I just love it when I pick up a book and it doesn't look like what I expect the book will look like.
Yeah. I remember that very vividly when I, because I was probably around the same age you were when I picked up The Gunslinger. I remember checking it out of my middle school library back in the day when you could have a Stephen King section in your middle school. And I don't know if it was just an Austin liberal hippie thing, but my middle school did have that little section where it was one shelf and it had the first three paperbacks of the Dark Towers. That was all that was out when I started reading, and I had that same reaction where I looked at the covers and I'm like, I had been reading Stephen King since, for a few years, a couple years at least up to that point, and I'm like, I don't know what this is. This is kind of like, I don't know, this looks a little like Lord of the Rings or a Western or something. I don't this maybe isn't my thing, so I kind of put it off. And I remember I had a one of those coaches that was also a teacher, that was teaching. I don't remember which subject it was, but like it came up in class. And Coach Kelly, I remember his name was Coach Kelly, and he noticed, I think, I was reading Stephen King. He was like, "Oh, have you read any of the Dark Tower books?" And I said, "No." And he's like, "Oh, you should check it out." And that's kind of what spurred me onto it. And I remember I picked up The Gunslinger and I did the thing where I'm like, "I'm not going to read this. This isn't for me." And I flipped through it and I hit the image of, which is the cover of the Grant edition, of Roland shooting at one of the slow mutants in the tunnel, and it's this glowing green
That's
mutant
my favorite
thing,
illustration.
and yeah, and it's all illuminated by the flash from the gunshot, and it's like this very striking image, and I'm like, okay, well, I'm checking this one out. I'm gonna read this. There is something, and I think Eyes of the Dragon has that too, where these little illustrations. I think King has been very smart throughout the years to either whether it's the cover of the books being able to draw people in, but it's more than just relying on his obvious talent as a writer. He gets these great, visual components. So we talk about, Cycle of the Werewolf being a great, almost comic book-esque, like somewhere in between a comic book and a traditional novel. And I think King, whether it was all planned out, by his mastermind status or just something he fell into, I think it's a really interesting how he's able to use not just his prose to draw people in, and I think that's a great example of it.
Very good.
And that's another way that I ripped off King in my Cycle of the Werewolf story in the Wereworld is that we brought on this fantastic horror artist, Francesco Francavilla,
Yeah,
and
yeah.
he did an illustration for every month, one of them is like of a mailbox that's bleeding,
I love it.
little dog foot sticking out of
Oh
it.
no. Trigger warning for those
Oh, sorry. For the
who
dog,
can't
I'm sorry.
handle. Yeah.
I have a question for you guys, and I'm gonna test your King nerd knowledge right now.
Oh God. Okay.
So we're turning the microphone around.
All right, let's do it.
It's time for an interrogation. What is your favorite line from Silver Bullet? Because I feel like it's infinitely quotable.
Oh my God. Well, pretty much anything that Uncle Red says. He has
Uncle
Jesus
Red.
j jumped up
Yeah.
on the cross or whatever. Jump,
Palomino.
G yeah, jumping Jesus Palomino. Yeah. That jumps out to me. I the thing that when you ask
Well,
that question,
the quote is "Holy jumped up bald-headed Jesus
there you go.
Palomino."
So I
This
got the
is
quote
prime
only a.
Gary Busey.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This is like where he was halfway between that. I don't know. Walken had the same phase, like right around the Dead Zone, where he becomes a caricature of himself at a certain point. But this is right when that's all fresh and it's really exciting. So him. But the thing that jumped into mind whenever you said that was the moment when Everett McGill is confronting Corey Haim on the bridge, and he has this great like, no, I'm trying to save people, like I'm saving them from their sin. And he's trying to justify him being a preacher and a monster at the same time. And when he has this moment where he like all the facade drops and he just starts calling like, you little shit, like, and like he where he's like pleading and begging, like, see me as the human, I'm a human, and all this stuff. And then when Corey Haim isn't having, he's like, you little meddling little shit. For whatever reason, that jumped out to me. That was the first thing that flashed into my mind whenever you.
That moment I never saw until I was an adult, because the version of Silver Bullet that I would watch over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Was recorded off TV, and there was a Persian Gulf warning news break.
Okay. Yeah.
During the bridge section. So all those years, I had no idea what happened on the covered bridge.
That's a lost thing. Again, like the kids these days, they have it so easy with their Netflixes and their Amazon Primes and whatnot. But like, you know, I remember having a copy. My favorite movie of all time is Jaws. And I had a copy that was almost all the, you know, VHS was so fucking expensive. Nobody, it was rare to own like the VHS in the early days where it was the actual, just the movie put out by the studio. You know, I was raised by a single mom. She was working multiple jobs. So we recorded off a TV. That was our VHS collection, right?
Yeah, that's the way.
And I had a copy of Jaws, you know, and you didn't waste tape. So you'd have a three or 4 hour, you know, tape, and you would have two movies on it, right? That would fit into that. And Jaws was the second movie on the tape. And it must have been like 5 hours because Jaws is a long movie. But anyway, it was a... it was the second movie on the tape. In the first movie, I don't ever remember what it was, but I know what the movie, the original thing is they recorded one movie, then Jaws. And then, and so I'd watch it that way. And then somebody had the bright idea of going, well, Superman is playing and we want that. And we want that more than the movie that's at the, you know, the first part of the VHS. So we're going to record over that first movie. And not realizing that Superman was also a much longer movie than the first movie. So for the bulk of my early development watching Jaws, Jaws started with the dudes on the pier doing the holiday roast thing because Superman recorded over the beginning of Jaws. And so the Superman would end and then it would go, and then it would be like, you know, all the tracking and all that, you know, VHS effect stuff. And then it was like, this is my wife's holiday roast, and like throwing the thing. And then the piers.
You never got Chrissy's last swim.
Not well, you know, and I'd seen it obviously before, but you know, when you needed to rewatch it, that was the only thing available to me. And then I remember it was a big deal whenever Jaws, you know, we ended up getting like an anniversary release on VHS and got to see it for the, you know, from the beginning again and have it where I could rewatch it. So anyway, that is a long story that has absolutely fuck all to do with anything we were talking about. But now you guys have heard it.
Nostalgia.
Well,
you know, in watching that copy of Silver Bullet over and over again, you know, just to show you how much it meant to me, I have to this day a baseball bat that I keep next to my bed, and etched into it is the Peacemaker.
Wasn't well, a lot of good that thing fucking did, though. Like the only buddy that got any use out of it was the werewolf. So
didn't they say it looks like Bigfoot used it for a toothpick? Wasn't that one of the lines?
That's an Uncle Red line, yeah. But never has a werewolf killed so many people with a baseball bat than in Silver Bullet.
That is true.
That bald-headed Palomino Christ thing. It reminds me, like so many of his books. I wonder if King invents these, or if these are things he's heard from, you know, local Yankee sayings or something up in Maine. But he has one, I think it's from The Stand, where a character, I can't remember who it is, goes, "Christ on a carousel." And I used to say that was something that I added to my own lexicon as a kid. And like,
it's funny how those little King idioms, like, you know, they worm their way into you and you can never get rid of them. Like sometimes I'll just be like doing the dishes or something. And you know, I'll be like, "It's not bitter, not sweet. It's a real frosted treat. Won't you buy a Rheingold beer?" Silver Bullet.
Yep.
He has those things that stick in your mind. He also had Jesus. I think Jesus jumped up on a pogo stick. Like Jesus is always up to some kind of shenanigans.
Jesus is always up to something.
Well, I think that brings us to a close here today. Anything more to say about Cycle of the Werewolf and Silver Bullet? Eric, shouldn't we plug? You've got a screening of Silver Bullet coming up.
I do. And if you're listening to this, if you and in Austin, I am doing a screening at the AFS Cinema with Mr. Stephen Graham Jones. We had screened previously Maximum Overdrive when he was on his book tour with I think it was My Heart Is a Chainsaw was when he did that. And we, you know, Steven's a great guy, and he is always been really kind to us here at the show, and he wanted to replicate that experience. So we're doing a screening of Silver Bullet, which was his pick. He was very excited to see it. Well, I'll tell you, we came down to two movies. We tried to get The Night Flyer, which is a very underappreciated King adaptation starring Miguel Ferrer. Problem with it is it's an HBO original. So it was an early HBO movie, and this is, you know, it's a very kind of cheesy, you know, early 90s. It has the production value of like one of a Skinamax show, you know, kind of, but it's all about this vampire that flies a Cessna from small airport to small airport. And, you know, then wrecks havoc, has a little snack, and then gets mm-hmm. back up in the air. Right. And
Miguel Ferrer's character, isn't it the guy, isn't it? I've not seen this movie. I've read the short story, mm-hmm. but isn't he the same character from The Dead Zone that works for like in what is that Insight, like the sort of cheesy tabloid?
Yeah, it's like Stephen
Inside
King's
View. Inside View.
Yeah, it's like Stephen King's National Enquirer, right? Yeah. And yeah, so he's a tabloid reporter hunting down all these stories, and Miguel Ferrer plays a fuck. He's a scumbag. This guy, he is just a shitty person. He's misogynistic. Mm-hmm. He's, you know, horrible to everybody. But there's some he's so shitty that he's likable in a weird way, you know, that it's like, yeah, this is just this earnest guy. And then, you know, earnest is the wrong word, but he's authentically himself. He's like, there is no bullshit mm-hmm. with this guy. He is just a shithead, and he's proud of it and lets that shithead flag fly. And it is a really fun movie. It has a really bizarre final act where there's a bloodbath at a kind of a bigger regional airport that is shot like a Lucio Fulci movie. You know, he goes artistically black and white. It's like probably like early version of what Tarantino did in Kill Bill, where there's too much blood or something, so they shoot it in black and white.
Is the blood red or is it black and white? All black.
Well, everything's black and white. So like it turns into like this kind of weird like ethereal, arty, otherworldly. There's fog and smoke everywhere. You know, it gets very theatrical. It's a really bizarre, really cool movie, but the rights to screen it officially become incredibly hard to track down. So we ended up settling on Silver Bullet, but he was just as excited about doing this. So anyway, AFS Cinema on Monday the 21st, me, Stephen Graham Jones, we're going to we're going to screen Silver Bullet. We're going to do a live recording of the show after talking about it. And then he's going to do a signing for his latest book. So come on out and buy a copy of his book, get it signed by him, and listen to us bullshit about Stephen King stuff.
Yeah, I will not be there, unfortunately.
We tried to get you out here. He was like, nope, I will not be in the same room as Stephen Graham Jones. No. He might force me to eat a well-done steak. We cannot have that.
So, I'll eat a steak. Yeah, you
cook it up, a well man. Done steak. I don't know.
Oh, is that it?
Yeah.
But Eric and I will be at Comic Con coming up, and Benjamin, you're going to be there too, right?
I'm going to be there too, nerding it up. I'm going to be on some Marvel panels.
Oh, hell yeah! Fun.
Fantastic. Eric and I are. It's been announced by Lionsgate. We'll be moderating the Hall H panel for The Long Walk. Stephen King's very first novel, published under the name Richard Bachman, but written when Steve King was a mere freshman at the University of Maine at Orono. And he wrote it to impress a girl. That girl is lost to history, but it's the first book that he finished, first novel he considers to be his first finished novel. And we'll be talking about the 50 plus year span in between, almost 60 years that it took to make it to the screen. And so we'll be there at Comic-Con. Check out Benjamin Percy on his Marvel panels. And as we close things out, Ben, tell us again, badhandbooks.com is where people should go to find the end times.
Yeah. Badhandbooks.com. Check it out. You can subscribe digitally there. And again, there's some bonuses that'll come with that, including donations to the ACLU and, you know, a discount on the collected volume of the end times.
Sounds like a deal, man. I can't wait for my first issue. When does this start?
November.
November.
So all right. Be perched on your mailbox or inbox.
I'm going to open the mailbox every day in November and be sad if it's not
there. It'll be like Charlie Brown on Valentine's Day.
Exactly. But thank you for being here with us. Thanks for breaking your news. And thanks to all you listeners out there. Check out the end times. Badhandbooks.com, right?
Hell yeah.
Here we go.
The Kingcast is hosted by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Anthony Bresnikin. The show is produced by myself as well as Abby Goel and Tara Ansley, and is distributed by the Fangoria Podcast Network. Daniel Danger is our art director, and the show was created by me, the late, great Scott Wampler.